Today's Taisho will be on case 26 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the gate of no barrier. Case 26. Two monks roll up the blinds. When the monks assembled before the midday meal to listen to his Taisho, the great Hogen of Seryo pointed at the bamboo blinds. Two monks simultaneously went and rolled them up. Hogen said, "One gain, one loss." Mumon's comment, "Tell me, who gained and who lost? If you have an eye to penetrate the secret, you will see where Seryo Kokushi failed. However, I warn you strongly against discussing gain and loss." Mumon's verse, "Rolling up the blinds, the great sky is open, but the great sky does not come up to Zen. Why don't you throw them all down from the great sky and keep your practice so close that no air can escape?" This Taisho, some of you are familiar with, this koan, that some of you are familiar with. It involves a guest lecturer by a famous Zen master. And he's come to the temple to give a guest lecture. This is the great Hogen of Seryo. And basically he's giving a Taisho, and there are some, maybe the room is a little little too dark. So he indicates that he wants the bamboo blinds to be rolled up. And as soon as he gives this indication, two monks jump up and roll up the blinds. So if you were in the room watching this, you see Seryo sitting at the front of the room. He indicates that the room is too dark and he wants the bamboo blinds rolled up. Two monks jump up at the same time. Now, you know, if you've seen monks, you know they all look the same, you know. They all wear the same robes. They all have shaved heads. They have no facial hair, no distinguishing features. One might be a little taller than another, one might be a little thinner than another, but pretty much a monk is a monk. You know? So the monks jump up, they rush over, they both grab the cords of the bamboo blinds at the same time, and they pull the cords down at the same time. The blinds roll up at the same time. Okay? So the teacher looks and he says, "One hit, one miss." See, this is a wonderful call. One hit, one miss. Of course, if you're going to work with a koan like this, you have to sit on the cushion and watch your breath until you can enter deep samadhi. And then you enter mushin, deep mushin, deep mushin. And probably the best way to work with this koan would be to say on your out-breath, "One hit." Next breath, "One miss." One hit. One miss. See, just like that. One hit. One miss. One, on and on. See, this is this would be Zen practice. Now, you know, we can understand this story intellectually. We can understand it psychologically or philosophically. So it's obvious that this is about somebody being approved of, somebody being approved of, and somebody being disapproved of, right? And so we have two monks, they're identical, and for some reason the teacher says, "You've got it, you don't have it. That seems to be what he's saying. One hit, you hit the bullseye, you missed the bullseye. Monks did the same thing. You know, so we might think to ourselves, there's some essence here. You know, this great master can just look at these two men and see, these two people, and see he's got it, he doesn't have it. And then, you know, of course, a lot of people, myself included, you know, when I worked with his koan, I of course would have thought of myself as being the monk who didn't have it. Right? Yeah. So, you know, there's a psychological dimension to this koan that's real. You know, there's a psychological dimension. We go through our lives and we want to do well, and often we don't, you know, succeed at what we're doing. We don't succeed. That's difficult to deal with, right? You know, how do you get beyond your failures in life? And since we all have failures, we all have things that don't go well for us, didn't go the way we planned. You know, no matter who we are, we have this sense that we're really the monk who didn't answer the question right, didn't do it right, didn't roll up the blind, you know. We had a wonderful a winter sesshin this year. It was rather unusual because it was so warm. It was a little spooky to, on day three I looked out the window and I saw people lying in the grass, you know, like as though it were June. You know, it was about 65 degrees. But everybody did a wonderful job at our winter sesshin. And, those sesshin is really, as I often say, you know, the heart of Zen practice. And it's where people can really concentrate, really focus in a sustained way. And as you know, if you've been to sesshin, on the last day people come in to talk about their experience of the sesshin. And somebody came in to see me, and the part that I'd like to talk about was just the person saying, well, you know, this happens to everybody. This person had been working very hard on a koan for the whole sesshin, sitting. And trying so hard, you know, to answer the koan. And didn't succeed. You know, last interview, comes in for Dokusan, doesn't have the answer. And it's difficult to be in the teacher's position because you're, of course, rooting for everybody. But if the answer is really not there, there's not much you can do. So you have to say, well, you know, that's a, you know, good work, you know, but just keep going. And the response was sort of like this. I thought I might be good at this. I thought I might be good at this, but, and sort of like, I was thinking this might be, I might have a knack for this, but obviously I don't. And this was sort of like, everybody has these moments, right? I mean, I think probably everybody has felt this or said this at some time in Zen practice. This sense that, you know, I'm not gonna get enlightened, I'm never gonna answer my koans, etc., etc., and it's a deep sense of defeat. You know, and I certainly understand that. You know, I've been to countless sesshin where I haven't answered my koan. And in my mind, you know, day one comes and I think I'm gonna answer it, day two comes and I'm gonna answer it, day three comes, I'm gonna answer it, day four, I'm going to get it, you know, day five, maybe I'll get it, you know, finally day seven comes, or day five, depending on the length of the sesshin, and you go in, you know, the fantasy is you're going to go in the last Dokusan and say, blah, 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 teacher, yes, you know, that's it. And that's happened to me. I've gone in the very last Dokusan and said something, and the teacher said, yes, that's, but, you know, a lot of times you go in and the teacher says, well, you know, good work, you know, but not quite. And this person just sort of had this sort of, a little bit self-pitying, right? It's a little bit self-pitying, like, oh, well, I knew I'd never do this. You know, I knew I could never climb that high mountain. And, this koan is addressing that in a way. It's saying, you've got to wrestle with this feeling that you have. You've got to somehow get beyond your self-pity, really. And, self-pity is really a kind of egotism, right? I mean, when you say, oh, well, obviously I'm never going to amount to anything in Zen, that kind of self-pity is very egotistical in a way. I mean, I certainly have my own forms of egotism, you know. So we all have to struggle with that element when we work with this koan. We all have to struggle with our sense of self-pity, our fears about not living up to our expectations, and our distrust of life. There it is again, our distrust of life, because we have a vision of what life might be, and then we think we're destined to be betrayed. So all of this is part of the koan. There is a psychological dimension to this koan that, you need to work through. If you work on this koan, one needs to work through. And there's also a philosophical dimension, the good and right and wrong, gain and loss, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once, right? We can't live in terms of success and failure. We know those are just ideas. That's not really the way of Zen to measure success and failure. Just be in the moment. So there's a philosophical dimension to this too. But usually koans are not just they have a psychological dimension, and they have a kind of philosophical dimension, or message, something like that. But really, koans also operate on a deeper level, and they're trying to get you to experience the moment in a new way. And I think that goes a little deeper than what we might call the psychological dimension or the philosophical dimension. They're really trying to change the way you experience this moment here and now. So when you sit down on the cushion and you enter samadhi and you enter mushin and you start saying, one hit, one miss, one hit, one miss. No. There's a long period of not knowing what you're up to. Then there's this, the psychological dimension begins to resonate, and you realize, I'm the monk who's never going to answer his koan, etc., etc. Then you might have some philosophical insights, but all of that's actually important, but actually not the deepest engagement with the koan. This koan is actually asking you to look at the moment here and now. Where is the hit here and now? Where is the miss here and now? See, one hit, one miss, one hit, one miss. And the thing about the terms hit and miss is that they are words that might have a deeper significance on an unconscious level. See, it might not literally be about hitting a target or missing a target. Don't be deceived by the literal meaning of the word. When you internalize the koan, this may resonate on a deeper level and awaken you to something that has nothing to do with really with hitting or missing. Those are just the triggers. Those are just the cues for a deeper experience of reality. This is really about connecting, not connecting. There's something here that on a deeper unconscious level has to take effect. I hope I'm being clear. But there's a kind of an unconscious processing that has to go on with every koan. And the goal is yes, to transform us personally, psychologically, yes, change the way we think consciously. But the deepest transformation takes place on this subliminal or unconscious level. And this is where the koan really does its work, really does its most important work. Right here in this moment, what is the hit? Right now, what is the hit? Right now, what is the miss? See, if you stop to think, try to work it out intellectually, you're a million miles from it. So you have to be in deep mushin, and you just have to keep processing this until the answer suddenly emerges from the deepest part of your awareness, really deeper than your consciousness can reach. And so, you know, when we work with koans, we're going through this process. We're moving from the psychological and the personal, which are real and important, down to a level that's beyond consciousness. And then there's a long period of gestation. It's like giving birth, right? You just have to be able to stay down in that condition for a long period of time. And the truth is, we really have to change. We really have to change. I was reading something the other day that I thought was sort of like koan training, sort of a bit like koan training. It was an article in the paper, and it said, math professor solves decades-old problem. And I'll just read you a little bit. A professor at the University of Missouri Columbia is being recognized for solving a math problem that stumped his peers for 40 years. The achievement has landed Stephen Hoffman an invitation to speak at the International Congress of Mathematicians in Madrid, Spain. Hoffman became curious about the problem as an undergraduate when a professor introduced him to it. So he was about 19 years old. The professor was unable to solve the problem. Hoffman, now 47, okay, this is not so different from koan practice, would have more success when the problem began to take over his life in 1996. Until he solved it in 2000, it was the last thing he thought about before he went to bed, and the first thing he thought about when he woke up. He spent 2 to 8 hours each day working on the problem. And sometimes he'd collaborate with colleagues. I could be out for a bike ride, he said, and I would be thinking about it. Sometimes I would stop everything and just write down what was occurring to me. So they go on and talk about the problem. If any mathematicians are here, it's called Cato's conjecture. I have no idea what that is. So I can barely add and subtract. But that's not much different, really, from Zen practice. See, that's not much different from Zen practice. Last thing he does before he goes to bed is he thinks about his koan. First thing he does when he gets that kind of engagement. Now, you know, when we see somebody do something like this, or we read something, we think this is just a technical issue, right? It's just a technical problem, and it's worked through by technical means. This is the idea that, you know, if you just manipulate ideas, the new way of seeing will present itself. Right? Just manipulating old ideas creates a new way of experiencing the world. That's the idea. So, you know, it is true. When you took algebra, and you took the algebra class, and you learned how to work through differential equations or something like that, multivariable equations. It's true. You didn't feel like you were being changed by it, right? You take the algebra course, you learn how to do the even, you know, my teacher in algebra used to say, do the even problems tonight, Now we do the even problems the next night, do the odd problems tomorrow night, you know. So that's how we learned algebra. Do the even problems, do the odd problems. So it didn't seem to change me, right? It didn't seem to change any of us, right? So we have this idea that, you know, learning doesn't require kind of like deep transformation. You know, it's just information. Maybe that's true. But the kind of practice we're engaged in when we're doing Zazen demands, you know, deep transformation. You have to, in order to see something new, you have to be willing to change. This is the essence of Zen practice. No. In order to see something new, you have to be willing to change. You know, your whole self. You have to be willing to change in your whole self. And it involves a process a lot like this professor working on the, you know, you have to engage, you have to go out on a limb. You know, this guy went out on a limb. You know, he was an undergraduate when he heard about this problem. And at some point in his life, he said, okay, this is my koan. This is my koan. And I'm going to engage with this koan because I have to. Now look, nobody else answered the question. What are the odds that he's going to be successful, right? But something about this gripped him. He had to do it. It's his karma. It's his destiny or his fate, whatever you want to call it. His true self told him, answer this, work on this question. His answer's not guaranteed, but the true self said, work on this question. So it grips him, and he gets up every day and thinks about it. He goes to bed every night and he thinks about it. You know, now, I believe he really had to be changed to answer this question. I think he really had to see in a new way. And to see in a new way, you really can't just recirculate the old ideas. This is what makes it difficult to answer a question like this. Any kind of, original insight, you know, really does require kind of inner transformation. And the koan, it really demands that kind of inner transformation. And my feeling is that at some point, you know, people may decide, I really don't want to change. You know, I really don't want to change. And if that's the case, then that's wonderful. You know, okay, fine. But if you want to answer your koan, I think you have to be willing to change. And you have to be willing to change. And what does that mean? It means I will do it no matter what the consequences, no matter how long it takes. You know, I will do it. This will be my question. This will be my koan. And I'm not going to calculate the years. I'm not going to calculate the days. I'm not going to calculate the hundreds of hours I spent on the cushion. And somehow, you know, when we have that kind of commitment and that kind of openness, wholeheartedness, you know, something can happen. We really can be changed, really can be changed. It's difficult. You know, it's a difficult process. I myself had a very hard time being wholehearted in my practice for a long time. I always felt, I guess, that there was a kind of transaction involved in Zen practice. It's like, if I do this, I should get this. You know, if I do this, I should get... So, you know, I've gone to a sesshin, and yet I haven't answered my koan. That's an injustice. Right? That's just unfair. And I really think on some level I actually thought that way, that, you know, this is unjust. You know, I started Zen practice just like everybody else at the same time. They're all answering their koans. I'm not answering my koans. This is unjust. You know? And I do think that for a while anyway, I had a kind of a resent, kind of chip on my shoulder, actually. And my feeling is that if you go to other Zen groups, you'll sometimes run into people who have a kind of chip on their shoulder. It's like, I've been practicing, but, you know, I just haven't gotten anywhere. And you'll meet such people. Even if they continue to practice, they have a kind of resentment about it. I myself fit into that category at one time. I'm sorry to say, or I'm embarrassed to say. It took me a long time to just realize that I did want to change. I really did want to change. I wanted my life to be different. And at that point, I really could practice. You know, because at that point, it was like, it's like rolling the dice. You know, I'm not happy with my life. I do want to change. I don't know where this is going to take me, but I'm going to give it a try. I'm going to go with it because something is telling me to go with it. And I think that's the proper spirit for Zen practice and proper spirit for working with a koan. That's what I mean by wholehearted. At some point, you just realize, okay, you know, there's no guarantee, but I'm going to do it with my, I'm going to do it and not to have a transactional mentality. It's not a business deal, right? You know, I think people get into, even in their relationships nowadays, we're encouraged to have a kind of transactional mentality. It's like, if you do this for me, I'll do this for you. And I think there is a kind of deeper relationship, right, which isn't transactional. It's like, you know, I love you, I care about you, you know, how, you know, whatever it takes, you know. And I think that's a deeper kind of relationship with other people. So, you know, you sit with your question, and you sit, and you sit, and you sit, and you sit. And basically, something has to happen in the deepest part of ourselves to answer a koan. But little by little, it's like we develop new eyes, or we develop new senses. I really believe this. You know, there was an article. An article just came out. It was released from. It was some researchers at Harvard, Yale, and Massachusetts Institute of Technology have been doing some work on brain structures of people who meditate. And interesting thing is that as you get older, certain key parts of the brain that deal with attention and sensory input become thinner and thinner. So this researcher, lead researcher, was named Sarah Lazar. She did a study of people who practice meditation on a quite regular basis. And she found that instead of the brain getting thinner, it gets thicker. It's like all of these new connections are woven through meditation practice. And it really is true. I mean, this is an empirical study. What it means, I don't know, but I think that when we meditate, we're learning how to experience the world in a new way. And it's like staring at a carpet from an odd angle, like a Persian carpet. You can't see any rhyme or reason. It just looks like a swirling mass of color. And then suddenly you see that there's a pattern there, and everything falls into place. You know. I don't know if they still exist, but at one time there was there were these pictures called Where's Waldo. I don't know, do those still exist? Okay. So you look at this jumble of images, it's a forest or something, and you're trying to find Waldo. You know, and you look and you look. Finally, all of a sudden, wow, there he is, you know. I think this is just like meditation. Only I think we have to sort of develop, we have to develop an awareness or a kind of apparatus. It's like we have to develop an apparatus we don't have when we start. It's like we have to grow the mental connections to see something. I really believe it's like this. You know, it's interesting. Light existed before there were eyes. Isn't that interesting? In evolution, light existed before there were eyes. Yeah. So we evolved eyes so we could experience light. See, that's a I think that's fascinating. See, and I think in Zen practice, this is what we're like, evolving organs to experience reality that isn't so obvious when you're in ordinary consciousness. It's like we're pushing at conscious. And this is not so crazy, right? I mean, all of these studies say that the brain is very malleable. You know, you can shape the brain to be sensitive or insensitive, aware or unaware. The brain can knit together many different things into wholeness, or it can fragment many different things depending on how the brain constructs itself. And this goes really back to ancient Buddhism. You know, the Buddha said, you are what you think. You are what you think. As you think, so you are. You know, so what we're trying to do in koan practice is change who we are and change how we experience the moment. It's like rewiring the brain. And who knows what happens to us when we sit? You know, people are just beginning to do studies. Who knows what happens when we go to sesshin? Again, I was reading this, I get this Nature magazine, and somebody has done a study of Arctic ground squirrels. Right? See, everything comes back to Zen. This is a... Not so, but for me it does, right? So I was reading this article on Arctic ground squirrels. And the interesting thing, again, it's about the brain. You know, these people are interested in animals hibernate, right? And when they hibernate, they're not stimulating any of their neurons, any of their synapses, right? They're not stimulating those connections. And if they're not stimulated, they go away. So animals that hibernate go into a mode where there's very little brain activity. And all of these mental connections decay. This is actually called degeneracy in the brain. And then they get up and they go out, right? They wake up and they go out and they look for berries or whatever. And you know, why aren't they idiots? Right? This is an interesting question. They seem to function very well, but they've lost all of this information. So this article says that, you know, they go into this mental state where the brain is sort of in a low operating mode. And then they come out of hibernation and they were shocked to find that there's an explosion of mental growth, right? They come out of hibernation and the mental connections, the branchings, just explode. There's this huge cognitive gain, all these fresh connections. And then, of course, there's so many that you have to get rid of some, and the ground squirrel's brain gets rid of some of them, but there's this huge burst of mental activity. And probably if you're a ground squirrel, right, you know, you get up, you know, groggy, you go outside, man, everything is so alive, right? You look at, oh my God, I haven't ever noticed, but the sun is so beautiful, you know. The grass, it's so alive, you know, and so tasty, you know. I never noticed these could taste like this, right? Mm-hmm. For a ground squirrel, it must be like this. Everything's fresh, everything's new. Sounds like sesshin, doesn't it? It sounds like sesshin. Maybe we're all hibernating at sesshin, you know, really. Maybe our brains do something like hibernation, and then, you know, boom, and you come out of sesshin, everything is so fresh, everything is so clear, right? It's just like this, maybe, who knows? I have no idea what I'm talking about. But I do know about Zen practice, you know, I'm not a brain scientist, but I do know that It's like trying to grow new eyes. It's like trying to hear with new ears. You know, this is a koan practice. And I do think all of a sudden, right in the moment, you're aware of something you weren't aware of before. It's right there. It's crystal clear. And right here and now, what is the hit? Right here and now, what is the miss? What you have to do is be in deep samadhi, deep mushin, and then you just look. And hit, miss. One hit, one miss, one hit, one miss. See? And this goes down, down, down into the deepest level of the mind. See? And then there's some kind of a transformation that takes place. And boom, it's like, you know what it is. You know. It's like right there in front of you, obvious a lot of the time. This is what Zen practice is all about. You know, so it's a little bit, along the way, as you develop your new eyes and your new ears, you know, you're becoming a different kind of person on many different levels. I mean, one of the good things about Zen practice, I believe, is that it really gives us a different perspective on life. You know, this guy, this mathematician, he isn't doing Zen practice, but he's very much, I think, like somebody who is. I mean, here's a guy who was engaged by a question when he was about 18 or 19 years old. And he's wrestling with it until he's 47 years old. Wasn't that what it said? And everybody he knows, people who are probably smarter than he is, are struggling with this question and not able to answer it, right? You know, now that's interesting, just in itself. What kind of a person... See, I mean, most of us don't have... I think this guy's probably not much smarter than any of us, really. But he has something maybe that we don't have, or at least I didn't have for a long time. He has a different kind of personality structure, really, you know? I mean, I think for most of my life, a lot of my life anyway, you know, I would have just said, oh, I'll never answer that question. I'll never answer this question. You know, the guys at Harvard haven't answered it. How can I answer it? Or, you know, I never win, you know, this sort of thing. A lot of people, when they encounter obstacles, fall apart right away. This was really... one of the best lessons I think that I ever learned from Zen was how to deal with failure. It's so important to be able to deal with failure, you know, not fall apart. I work with people who are writing their dissertations, and for many people who write their dissertations, they're trying to make sense of something. That's really new information. So there's no guarantee, right? There's no guarantee that they're going to come up with an answer. And, you can get 6 months into a project and suddenly realize it's not going to pan out. You know, that happens to people all the time. And I often have to deal with, say, graduate students who have put a lot of time and effort into, say, a chapter or dissertation. And there's something fundamentally wrong with it, you know, and you can't see that until you get deeply into it. And it's interesting to see different kinds of people respond to this in different ways. There's some people who just really lose it, you know, they start beating up on themselves and they blame this, oh my God, I totally screwed up, you know, fall apart. And if you're the mentor to such a person, and there's many people, very gifted people who are like this psychologically, you know, you want to help them. You say, oh, come on, you know, you'll solve it. I know you can do it. blah, blah, blah. And they can, you know, it's just their personality structure is so fragile. And maybe it's education that makes people like that. You know, we're so used to being approved of and getting a good grade on every test and having a teacher go, oh, you're such a good student, you know. And then, you know, what happens when, you know, we wash out, we just crumble. It's like our whole self-image falls apart. Occasionally you meet people who are a little bit more flexible. They're a little bit more resilient in their personal structure, you know. And I think Zen really helps us to be like that, not to be so daunted by setbacks and defeat, you know, to develop this kind of patience, you know. I can remember once sitting in the morning with Genki Roshi, and I was going through a really difficult time. I had was taking classes in graduate school, and I had been reading a lot of work by a famous literary critic whose name was Jacques Derrida. Some of you may or may not have heard of him, but he's a sort of a controversial literary critic. His approach was very different, and I had started reading his stuff and found it very exciting. And I was taking a course with a guy whose name was, I probably won't give you his name because he's still around. But his first name was Don, let me just put it that way. And he's not at Rutgers at all. He's in another university. Okay. So Don gave me, Don hated Derrida, which I didn't know. I'm just a student, a graduate student. I walked into his class, we were reading Wordsworth poetry. So I was reading all this Derrida stuff, and I wrote this paper. It was using Derrida to talk about these poems. And I got the paper, I was so excited to get the paper back, you know. And so I opened the paper, and there's a big fat F. An F, right? Oh my God, right? I just couldn't believe it, you know, F. And he said, and the comments were so scathing. He says, this is utterly irresponsible, almost dishonest, you know. Holy smokes, you know, this is like my second year of graduate school. So I had stepped into a hornet's nest, right? And, you know, I was going through this. I was doing a lot of jogging, let me put it that way. And trying to get rid of the stress. And I went up, I was sitting every day up at Kugeon at Genki Roshi's house. When, at that time, we were sitting there. And I don't know how he knew, but maybe somebody else was having some problems. But he said something in the Zendo. He said, you know, life is absolutely impossible. And when he said that, I just thought, yes, that is so true. You know, absolutely impossible. And so, you know, the only answer, I thought, was just to go deep into mu, deep into mu, deep into mu. You know? And somehow I got out of that scrape, you know. I rewrote the paper, you know, I was able to get myself together, pull myself together, rewrote the paper, turned it in, and I went and met with the teacher, said, look, I've rewritten the paper, I see what you're saying, please give me another chance, you know. He read the paper, it was pretty much what he wanted to hear. Hey, wonderful. And left the class and never took another class with him. But it helped me so much. Life is impossible. Life is impossible. So you know this koan has many different dimensions. But most important thing about one of the most important things about Zen practice. Is developing a kind of, I think, a personality structure that allows us to be in a condition of uncertainty, and really receptivity, openness, right? For long periods of time. At the same time, I think under the surface, you know, there's this reformulation going on, this sprouting new eyes, developing new ears, you know, new senses. What's really happening, I think, is that, you know, the unconscious mind is such a big processor of information. You know, if you walk into a room sometimes, you can come into a room where two or three people are sitting, and you can sit down, and all of a sudden you can feel the hostility, right? Maybe there's been an argument, and you can come into that room and just feel it. You sense, uh-oh, something's gone on here before I came into this room. And it's interesting, how do you know, right? But I think your unconscious mind is picking up all of these cues from the environment. Who knows, maybe it's even smell. You know, maybe you come in and you actually smell the hostility, you know. But probably you pick up something in body language, there's something about the silence, who knows? You don't think it through, you just suddenly become aware that there's tension in the room, right? How do you know that? So it's like the big mind is processing all of this information, and little mind only works with what it already knows. Little mind just works with what it already knows. What has to happen is that we have to use big mind to get beyond the limits of what we already know. And when we're struggling with the koan and we're sitting there going, one hit, one miss, one hit, we're really activating deeper mind, bigger mind, and it's going to give us what we need to see in a new way. This is the essence of Zen practice. So, you know, you need to develop a kind of personality structure that can be in that uncertainty for long periods of time without cracking up, beating up yourself, hating yourself, feeling betrayed, and so on. And the interesting thing is that if you just stay in that state long enough, you know, you develop this wonderful trust in life, wonderful trust. Whether you answer your koan or not, if you experience the world in a more complete way, more open way, more connected way, you know, success or failure aren't so important. Aren't so important. In fact, they're really beside the point. Right? Two monks roll up the blinds. When the monks assembled before the midday meal to listen to the lecture, the great Hogen of Seryu pointed at the bamboo blind. See, this is somebody everybody wants to be. Everybody wants to be admired by the great Hogen of Seryu, right? Want to be the great Hogen, want to be admired by him. So the monks are trying to impress this guy. He's the Dalai Lama, right? He's the great Hogen of Seryu. They rush up, they do their best. He says, one hit, one miss. You've got it, you don't have it. Take a year, I take 10 years. You know, at some point you say, I really want to change. And when you say that, it doesn't matter if it takes 10 years or 100 years. It doesn't matter. So that number one obstacle in Zen practice is really that people don't want to change. And that's something each of us has to decide for ourselves. At some point in my life, I wanted to change so much I didn't care if I ever answered another koan. I just wanted to change, and I knew somehow that this was the path to change. So the real obstacle in Zen practice is just that one question, do you want to change? Momo's comment, tell me, who gained and who lost? If you have an eye to penetrate the secret, you will see where Serio Kokushi failed. Even the great Serio failed. Oh my gosh. However, I warn you strongly against discussing gain and loss. Mumon's verse. Rolling up the blinds, the great sky is opened. Big mind, we roll up the blinds, big mind is open. But even the great sky doesn't come up to Zen. This is bigger than the sky. Mushin is bigger than the sky. He says, why don't you throw them all down from the sky? Throw it all away. Throw it all away. Do you want to change or not? Yes, throw it all away. Keep your practice so close that no air can escape. This is like when we're in deep samadhi, it's like being at the bottom of the ocean, isn't it? You know, yesterday somebody came to see me and he was telling me about his experience of deep samadhi, and it's like being at the bottom of the ocean, right? Just like the depths of the depths of the depths of the depths. This is where change takes place. This is where we Zen men and Zen women live our lives. So, thank you for coming today. I really look forward to our next chance to practice together.